VOA News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. The Palestinian militant group Hamas said Tuesday it will accept an Egyptian-mediated ceasefire agreement if Israel does the same. But Israel's government did not appear to do so. Its UN ambassador Danny Dannon told reporters in New York late Tuesday, in advance of an emergency UN Security Council meeting, that we take action to protect our people and will continue to do that. Dannon said Hamas militants had launched 460 rockets into Israel between Monday and Tuesday, and he warned if it will not be quiet in Israel, it will not be quiet in Gaza. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis plans to visit American troops at the southern border Wednesday, Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
The Pentagon says Mattis will meet with troops in McAllen, Texas. About 1,000 of the 5,800 active duty troops assigned to the border mission are on or near the border in South Texas. President Trump ordered troops to the border in response to a migrant caravan slowly moving through Mexico toward the U.S., but the lead caravan is no longer heading that way, with most migrants appearing to move toward Tijuana. Does that change the military's mission?
We'll have to see what the future holds, but right now that's the only mission I have.
Mattis says the Pentagon's still calculating how much the mission will cost.
President Trump used Twitter on Tuesday to strongly criticize France and its president, Emmanuel Macron. Trump noted Macron's low approval ratings and attacked French tariffs on U.S. wine exports, as well as its failure to meet NATO's defense spending goal. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization is the West's main defense alliance. This is VOA News. The notorious Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman is being tried in New York, where security is extremely tight. Associated Press correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
The trial of El Chapo is taking place in a Brooklyn federal courtroom that has been tightly secured owing to the defendant's history of escaping prisons in Mexico. Prosecutor Adam Fels told the anonymous jury they'll hear Joaquin Guzman in his own words. They'll see text messages he sent as he shipped hundreds of tons of cocaine into the U.S. He described how Guzman built his reputation by building tunnels under the Mexican border. Defense attorney Jeffrey Lichtman claimed in his opening that the real boss of the cartel was another drug kingpin who bribed Mexican authorities to keep his freedom while Guzman languished in prison.
Despite Guzman's capture, the bloody Sinaloa cartel remains lucrative. Analysts have said the organization's decentralized command structure has allowed it to carry on without its most famous member. Facebook said Tuesday it's been unable to determine who is behind or who was behind dozens of fake accounts it took down shortly before the 2018 U.S. midterm elections. At least one of the Instagram accounts it closed had well over a million followers, according to the company. The number of hate crime incidents reported in the United States jumped by 17% last year. That is the largest increase since 2001, when the terrorist attacks of 9/11 fueled a surge in attacks on Americans of Muslim and Arab ancestry. American law enforcement agencies reported a total of 7,175 hate crimes in 2017. That's up from 6,100 in 2016. It's the third consecutive annual increase. The FBI reported its annual hate crime statistics on Tuesday. About 5,000 of the incidents were listed as crimes against persons, such as assault and intimidation. The report showed a doubling of anti-Arab hate crimes and double-digit increase in anti-Semitic incidents. CNN has filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration in an effort to restore access for its chief White House correspondent Jim Acosta, who had his press credentials revoked. The White House press secretary Sarah Sanders is dismissing the lawsuit as, quote, more grandstanding from CNN. She said the administration stands by its decision to revoke Acosta's credentials. Sanders said after Mr. Acosta asked the president two questions, he physically refused to surrender a White House microphone to an intern. You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world, around the clock, at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The opposition coalition in the DRC has chosen a unified candidate ahead of the December presidential election.
I was happy, and I thank God, and thank people of Congo. You know that I fought all my life to have democracy in Congo, and now the time is for us to really have fair and credible election in Congo.
Martin Fayulu is the candidate for the opposition coalition in the DRC. Today is the first anniversary of the removal of Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe from office. Kenya's development plan gets a boost from international partners, and Gabon's main opposition accuses the government of lying about President Ali Bongo's health.
We want the prime minister to go to Riyadh to see the president and all the medical staff is taking care of him. If there is a problem, to come back and to decide if the president is still on his capacity to run the country.
Paul Marie Gonju is the Deputy Executive Secretary of the National Union Party. South Sudan's government is urged to allocate more money to institutions of higher learning, and a conference in Dakar, Senegal this week on how West Africa can reach its electricity goal from renewable energy. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Congo's main opposition presidential candidate, Martin Fayulu, is calling on other opposition leaders to unite behind his campaign in the run-up to the December 23rd general election. Fayulu, a Congolese parliamentarian, was chosen by leaders of the major opposition parties as their candidate to challenge Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari of the ruling People's Party for Reconstruction and Democracy in the presidential election. But Fayulu's election has come under strain, with supporters of the two leading opposition parties demanding their leaders withdraw from the agreement. Martin Fayulu spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Geneva, Switzerland.
I was happy, and I thank God, and thank people of Congo. I was prepared for that responsibility. I was prepared, and you know that I fought all my life to have democracy in Congo, and now the time is for us to really have a fair and credible election in Congo.
So what should the people of Congo expect from you?
What they have to expect is just the fair, credible election without a voting machine, without the fake electoral register. What they have to expect from us is that we will do our best for them to have tomorrow the people who represent the Congo that they have voted themselves.
How confident are you that they will all rally behind you in the challenge against the ruling party presidential candidate in the upcoming December elections?
I cannot doubt on their commitment. They have committed themselves. Everybody has committed and signed an agreement. We were requesting for the state of law, and I think that all of us, we have now to respect our word and also our signature. I don't have any doubt that all my colleagues will go for what they have decided themselves.
The news came that Felix Tshisekedi's supporters are saying that he should get out of the agreement that he signed, which effectively chose you as the leader of the opposition in the upcoming December 23 presidential election. How do you react to that?
The member of UDPS, maybe they have right to protest, because, but that doesn't mean that he has to withdraw. That's why I'm saying that I'm calling Felix to come back to the agreement. He's a friend, he's a brother, and he has to come back to the agreement because he signed, and we cannot let him out. He fought. UDPS fought for the democracy. We were together. We have done many things together, and he has to come back. This is my prayer. This is my request. Felix Tshisekedi and Vital Kamerhe, they have to come back. They have to reconsider their position. I know that they went very fast ahead trying to respond to their members, but their leaders leader mean that you have to show the pace and the member, they have to follow you.
Martin Fayulu is Congo's main opposition presidential candidate for the December 23rd general election. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from Geneva, Switzerland. Gabon's main opposition National Union Party has accused the government of lying about President Ali Bongo's health. Paul-Marie Gonjou, the deputy executive secretary, says the party is demanding that Prime Minister Emmanuel Issoze Ngonde travel to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, with a national delegation to see President Bongo and speak with the doctors who are taking care of him. Mr. Bongo has been hospitalized in Saudi Arabia for 3 weeks now, but his government has been giving conflicting information about his illness and his condition. Gonjou says these conflicting messages have been harmful to the country.
They are lying about the health condition of Mr. Bongo. At the beginning, they were telling us that he was suffering from light fatigue. And then this light fatigue transformed to a severe fatigue. Today, they are telling us that he has a kind of bleeding. They don't tell us on which part of his body that he has the bleeding. He's on the foot, on the arm, bone, head, and all, we don't know where. And then they are saying that he's in better condition. I don't know how you can explain that the guy 15 days ago had a light fatigue, and then he has a bleeding, obliging medical and surgical attention, and being in better condition. They just have to tell us what is going on, actually. And that's the reason why we said that they are telling lies about his health condition.
So you are saying that by the government not being forthcoming, that this is going to hurt the country? How is that going to hurt the country?
I mean, definitely yes, because the president is a kind of center of the political system in Gabon, and the president has to sign laws. He has to appoint minister and ambassadors and whatever. And the president not being there, the political system is just blocked. But if he's seriously sick or dead, that's a problem for the country. That's the reason why we said that we need to know what is his health condition. Is in the capacity of running the country? Is he in capacity of taking all his responsibilities as a president? All those questions we want the government to answer.
So, Paul, you are suggesting that, according to what I'm reading, that the opposition wants the prime minister to go to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, with what you call a nationally representative delegation to meet with President Bongo. Members of the opposition to be in the delegation to go to Riyadh?
The National Union, my party, said that we want the prime minister to go to Riyadh and to see the president and all the medical staff who are taking care of him, because he's the one. If there is a problem, if there is a vacancy at the head of the power, to come back and to meet with all those other ministers and to decide if the president is still on his capacity to run the country.
Paul-Marie Gonjou is the deputy executive secretary of the main opposition leader John Pien's National Union Party. He was speaking with me from the Gabonese capital, Libreville. Today's Wednesday, November 14th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's ruling ZANU-PF party says Zimbabweans have more freedoms today than when they were under former President Robert Mugabe, who ruled the country for more than 38 years. The statement comes on the first anniversary today, Wednesday, of the removal of Mr. Mugabe from power by Zimbabwe Defense Forces. Ruling party activists say Zimbabweans should work together to tackle the country's current economic crisis. Believe Gawley, a member of ZANU-PF's powerful central committee, tells viewers Zimbabwe Gives Dube that President Mnangagwa has transformed the political landscape in the country for the benefit of all Zimbabweans.
A lot has changed, and people are free. It is, remember, it's enshrined in our constitution that Zimbabwe is a democratic country, is a multi-party state, and really parties were free to campaign in a peaceful environment. And this was emphasized by the president, new president Emmerson Mnangagwa. And really, people are happy about that. And that is why even people voted for him. And yes, we have these challenges that we are faced. These obstacles, as I speak right now, I think the government is doing something about it to address some of the challenges that we are facing at the moment. But all that I can say is that people should be patient and wait. Because you remember, let me really emphasize on what the finance minister is always saying, that give us a chance. At least about 6 months down the line, we're realizing the changes that will then come about.
So we see that ZANU-PF is saying a lot about freedom of expression, freedom of movement, and all the freedoms that are now said to be in the country. But is it that people are free to say what they want, as it is right now?
Yes, people are free to say what they want. You know what? Remember, we're moving from the Mugabe era. And really, the lot of changes have come about. But really, people must learn to appreciate. Yes, of course, some incidents here and there, some pockets here and there. But we really appreciate what's happening right now and what the government has achieved in terms of maintaining the freedom of expression, freedoms, all these other freedoms. And really, people are really happy about that. And I really appreciate. It's only that people in the opposition are the only people who don't even appreciate some of the changes that have taken place.
Do you see the economic situation changing as soon as possible in Zimbabwe, and what will make it change?
You can say that our cabinet is made up of technocrats. And you remember, let's take, for example, the best finance minister that we have, especially the Muthule Ncube. That man, he doesn't know even the ZANU-PF slogan. He's not a ZANU-PF member. But he was hired by the president to do work. And remember, he is from countries like us, Switzerland, where he's been doing that there and doing very well. But really, what we're looking at is to give him a chance, give him time to do his work, so that maybe you can evaluate his work after a period of 6 months or so. Then that way, people can say, this man has failed, or this man is not doing anything, or this man is really doing a wonderful job for this nation. That's when people can start saying all that.
Going forward, Mr. Kaule, what's the role of the National Army in Zimbabwe?
The role of the National Army is enshrined, remember, it is enshrined in the Constitution, that the role of the Army is to protect the citizens of this country. And that simple is the role of the Army.
And they shouldn't interfere in politics, right?
And they mustn't interfere in politics. They mustn't, really. Remember, Zimbabwe is not a military state. That one is really clear, and it is enshrined in our constitution.
Belief Gawley is a member of the ruling ZANU-PF Central Committee. He was speaking with Gabe Tube from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. United Nations agencies, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund have endorsed the Kenyan government's development plan, saying it is poised to make Kenya an economic center in Africa. Speaking in Nairobi after meeting with Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto, the representative said they have offered to mobilize resources and work together with the government in transforming the country. Maureen Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
The support for Kenya's Big Four agenda funding comes at a time when the country is in a crisis on how to pay back billions of dollars in loans owed to China. Speaking yesterday, Tuesday, in Nairobi, Deputy President William Ruto expressed his full support for the United Nations to help Kenya in attaining the goal of the agendas. Ruto says Kenyans will benefit.
You can count on the President and myself to fully support your important work to deliver the Big Four and the UNDA for the benefit of every Kenyan. Tomorrow, we will be having a big meeting with our UN development partners, which you will be part of. That is part of our consolidation of all the efforts so that we can focus on results.
The United Nations Resident Coordinator Siddharth Chatterjee said that the intensified public-private partnership, innovations and technology will be the main drivers of the renewed efforts to working with the Kenyan government in implementing its development plan. He said in the next 5 years, The United Nations Development Assistance Framework will act as a blueprint for the UN support in Kenya that will see 21 specialized UN agencies, including the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, contribute $1.9 billion towards Kenya's development agenda.
We actually have disaster risk reduction, response to refugees, response to IDPs embedded into this plan. Perhaps time for us to get a little more adventurous and thinking about a humanitarian city in Kenya.
The 2018 to 2022 UNDA framework is essential to make sure that we get the key achievements and deliverables that you've outlined in your vision to be accomplished. And in this, all UN agencies, including the World Bank and IMF, have completely committed to it.
Kenya's United Nations Development Programme Country Director Amanda Serumanga and the World Health Organization representative Agnes Rudolph said that their corresponding agencies are ready to partner with the government in ensuring safety and universal healthcare to the Kenyan people.
All of the things that drive poverty, be it access to services, safety and security of communities, and so on. But let me begin with the first outcome area, and I want to just highlight that this basically deals with the law, people's access to it, its services to the people, the guarantees that commercial actors can have within the justice system.
We've had good experiences actually in the previous UNDAF in terms of delivery in this area of work. We've been very heavily involved in the design of the UHC in Kenya, how that will roll out. And in fact, we know that the first counties are now on board to actually deliver UHC.
President Uhuru Kenyatta's Big Four agenda for his final term are manufacturing, universal healthcare, affordable housing, and food security. Today, Wednesday, Deputy President William Ruto is expected to meet again with nations' development partners to focus on the outcome of the designated framework. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Yamorino Jembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Heads of public universities and students across South Sudan are calling on the government to allocate more money to institutions of higher learning to improve conditions for lecturers and students. The vice chancellor of the University of Juba says the Ministry of Education should act to protect South Sudanese universities and colleges. Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
Vice chancellors from the universities of Juba, Baragazal, Upper Nile, Rumbek and Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology met with members of the Parliamentary Committee on Education recently to discuss the challenges facing public universities. Professor John Akech, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Juba, says rather than receiving funds directly from the Finance Ministry, public universities fall under the Education Ministry and therefore receive their funds directly from that ministry. Speaking on behalf of the country's institutions of higher learning, Akech says South Sudanese public universities should be allowed to run their own affairs rather than being instructed by the Education Ministry.
Universities worldwide are autonomous financially, academically, and because professors are more qualified to know who is a student who actually can do this program.
Akech says low salaries and poor working conditions have forced many university lecturers and professors to quit teaching altogether. Akech is urging Parliament to increase the budget for education and allocate more money for lecturers and professors.
In fact, a professor now earns something like $100, a lecturer earns something like $50. And so people are leaving universities and are going to work with NGOs. So this threatens the future of higher education in the country.
Akech says public universities are unable to raise money for operating costs from tuition alone. He says vice chancellors proposed increasing tuition fees by 300% in 2016, a proposal rejected by the Education Ministry.
The students of social science are paying about $2,200 a year. The student of medicine is paying less than $4,000 a year. And these are the money we need to run the university, to buy the paper, to run the cars, to buy fuel.
A first-year student at the University of Juba who prefers to be identified by her first name only for fear of reprisals from authorities says students miss classes because the lecturers have low morale due to their poor pay. Jen says rather than teaching, some lecturers do part-time jobs to earn money because they cannot live on their university salaries. And she says classes are overcrowded.
The number of students is more than the seats, which means sometimes if you come late, you have to stand or you carry a seat from outside to inside. That's when you sit comfortable. And second thing also, we don't have electricity in this university. which means if it is raining and the lecturer is supposed to come in, no way for lectures because it will be dark.
The government passed a fiscal 2018-2019 budget of 82 billion South Sudanese pounds, the equivalent of $584 million. Of that amount, 7 billion South Sudanese pounds, or nearly 8%, was allocated to the education sector. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
A conference is being held this week in Dakar, Senegal, on how West Africa can reach its electricity goal from renewable energy.
So if we want to get move on to sustainable energy projects, which generally can be very small, then you have to group them to create the scale and attract the market. So for small pieces like solar home systems, where people put on the rooftop just one panel and you get your light and whatever you may need, you could increase that to two, you will never get any finance. So we came out and said, okay, we are going to do it for 10 million people. We create a project, we say it's costing us $200 million. Who can support us? Luckily, we got the World Bank. Who responded to this?
And what is the biggest project you have to scale at the moment in the region then?
The biggest we have to scale is what's called the Sula Corridor, which we're talking of 2 gigawatts. But that's 2,000 megawatts of solar, installed solar generation capacity, grid connected in the Sahel. This is the biggest, and this is estimated at, you may say, $2 billion.
And why is it innovative? Because it's connecting different countries. Other countries are sharing solar power?
Yeah, it's innovative in the sense that it's the biggest project of its kind in the region, and even it will be the biggest project of its kind in the world.
When you say of its kind, what do you mean?
In terms of 2 gigawatts of solar generation capacity ever to be constructed, there is no single project like that. Hell, it's a vast area. We have enough space to put 2 gigawatts.
And enough sun.
Enough sun. So this is probably what the biggest project, single project that can be developed anywhere else in the world. And at what stage is that? We've identified locations in the region where this can be developed. We try now mobilizing the political will from the member countries to take up interest, and we go in as we have signed a common treaty for developing this project. The treaty has not yet been signed. It's in the development process now. So we believe that come another 4 or 5 months, the treaty will have been signed and the project will then start looking for the funding to get it developed. We have 4 or 5 different locations that are identified suitable for it and can take that size.
Where are those locations?
It's located somewhere between Senegal and Mali, and somewhere in the middle of Mali, and in border called Burkina Faso. And these are the areas we have identified that can absorb this amount of energy into the grid.
And how many people potentially could that grid serve?
Wow, if you talk of 2 gigawatts of generation capacity, that could take us to over, we could talk of probably, if you talk of households, it's talking of, we could talk of probably 20 million households.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. Congo's main opposition presidential candidate, Martin Fayulu, is calling on other opposition leaders to unite behind his campaign in the run-up to the December 23rd presidential election. Fayulu, a Congolese parliamentarian, was chosen by leaders of the major opposition parties as their candidate to challenge Emmanuel Ramazani Shadary of the ruling People's Party for Reconstruction and Democracy. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
Is there a leadership deficit in Africa? Does the continent lack leaders who are compassionate about their citizens and believe in strong institutions? Host Shaka Sali returns to lead a discussion on the importance of strong leaders and strong institutions on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's worldwide music request hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.